Good evening, everybody. Let's start with our motivation. And really with our own wish, heartfelt wish to be happy and not have any suffering. And don't think of suffering here just as the ouch kind. Think of how we don't want the disappointment that comes from the dukkha of change. And we don't want to live on the edge of a cliff with the pervasive conditioning dukkha. And how wonderful it would be to find a state free of that. And just as we seek that, so does everybody else. Whether they have the words and the concepts or not, everybody is seeking some state of lasting peace. And although we feel that our own situation is quite important, we're one of many, and the many have been very kind to us. And also seeing the disadvantages of being self-preoccupied and neglecting others, and seeing how they want happiness as intensely as we do. Then let's expand our mind to work for the well-being of all others and to temper this rampant elephant of our own self-centeredness. And so to engage in the Bodhisattva path in order to do that. So generating the supreme thought of enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And trying to live our lives in accordance with that as much as we can. So generate that now. Sometimes when we think of sentient beings, you know, we think of the specific people we know, they seem really so solid and real, you know, and it's kind of like, it's going to be Lisa, and then Lisa's future life, and Lisa's future life after that, and they're all somehow going to still be Lisa. Yeah, you know, kind of look basically the same. You know, next life a little bit younger at the beginning, and, you know, then age and like that. But still kind of basically look the same, act the same, you know. So that way we look at it is very involved with grasping at true existence and grasping at there being some kind of permanent soul or self, you know, something that is the person. So, you know, really when we're generating bodhicitta, although, you know, we really think of individuals and generate love and compassion for them, when we think of them, we have to make sure that we're not thinking of them as truly existent individuals. You know what I mean? Yeah? Because then, otherwise we say, well, all sentient beings have been my mother, but then it's hard to imagine, you know, that mouse having been my mother or my mother becoming that mouse. It just doesn't seem to fit because, you know, we're grasping at everything as having some kind of self when it doesn't. And so things, you know, people's incarnations can change radically from one life to the next. And there's no permanent self or soul kind of going through all of this. And yet, there is a continuity from, you know, previous lives to present lives to future lives. And all these beings have still been kind to us. Yeah. So, you know, don't just think, oh, I'm generating bodhicitta for my parents of this life and everybody who's nice to me this life. Yeah, because the people who were nice to us this life in a previous life, you know, harmed us and were our enemies and hurt our feelings. Yeah, and the people who we don't like this life were, you know, our parents and our lovers in previous lives. Yeah. And so we've had all sorts of different relationships with all these different beings. So don't try and see anybody as some kind of, you know, permanent self or soul or this whole thing of what do they call it? What's this new age term of, you know, soul mates or something? Is that it? You know, you come up with your soul mate. I remember one time some years ago talking with a Buddhist friend of mine who had recently gotten married, and he was telling me about his wife and how he's sure that they were together in many previous lives because they just have this automatic, very strong connection, and that, you know, will probably continue into future lives. And I said, that sounds like a permanent self to me. And he kind of tried to say, no, 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 it's not. But it sure sounded like one. Yeah. So we have to be careful about that kind of thing. And even when regarding people in this lifetime, we say, well, that's their personality. Yeah. Actually, what a personality is just a conglomeration of different habits. And all a habit is similar types of behavior that are done with some frequency. But that doesn't make some kind of solid person at all. So we need also to be careful about that. Otherwise we just form an image of somebody in our mind. And, well, that's who they are. That's the way they are. They can't change. I can't change in relationship to them. Yeah. So not only doing that for others, but also for ourselves. So that's just a little bit by way of introduction, because now we're going to go into establishing mindfulness on the mind, and the mind is one of the things that we tend to cling to as being the basis of who we are. You know, we may strip away, well, I'm not my body, I'm not my feelings, you know, I'm not discrimination, I'm not my different emotions, but I'm my mind, you know. Okay, so we can see as we're doing these four establishments that we're going from coarser to more subtle. The body is very coarse, made of material. Feelings are a little bit more subtle. Mind is even more subtle. And then with phenomena, we'll be talking about different mental factors and also some of the factors of the path. Okay, so it's said that the mind has the nature of the observer. Okay, so the mind is what observes, the mind is what cognizes, what feels, what experiences, what perceives. It's the whole part of us that makes us a living being. Okay. When we look at a corpse, there's something that's not there when there's simply a corpse. What is it? It's the presence of the mind or consciousness. So mind does not just mean the intellect. It's referring to that whole cognitive, emotional, experiential part of us. And it can also be translated as heart. You know, somebody has a good heart. Good mind, good heart, something like that. The mind, when we're talking about the primary mind, is neutral. It's not virtuous, it's not non-virtuous. There's different mental factors that may be there with the mind or with different consciousnesses. And they may be virtuous, non-virtuous, and neutral. But the actual primary consciousness that sees, you know, that type of object, that objective field, itself is neutral. And I'll get into that a little bit in a minute. So we examine the mind because it controls the body and the speech. Yeah. Like I was saying, the body is very gross, the speech is a little bit more subtle, the mind is more subtle. It sometimes feels as if we talk and do things without our mind being involved at all, but that's not true. Yeah, the speech, the mouth does not move to communicate unless there is an intention in the mind. Except for reflex actions in our body, the body does not move unless there's an intention of the mind. And so in terms of learning to manage the different aspects of ourselves, we start with our physical actions because they're the grossest. You know, for an intention to become a physical action, there's some time lapse that goes on there, even though it might seem very quick sometimes. There's a build-up. Yeah, it starts with the mind and then, you know, builds up and finally is expressed physically. Similarly with communication, with, you know, what we call the speech, there's a build-up. There has to be an intention involved. Whereas with actions of the mind, we don't have to move, we don't have to say anything, but the mind is moving, the mind is doing a lot. Okay, so we come back to the mind because if we're able to manage or control our mind, then our speech and our body follow along. This thing going from mind to speech to body, this is also why when we take precepts, we start with the Pratimoksha precepts, the one for individual liberation, which are the five precepts and the one-day precepts and the various kind of monastic precepts, because all of those, to actually transgress them, there has to be a physical or verbal action. Just having the motivation alone without anything being done by the body or speech is not a full transgression. So those precepts are the easiest ones to keep. Okay? The not killing, not stealing, not having unwise, unkind sexual behavior, not lying, not taking intoxicants. Those are the easiest precepts to keep because there's going to be this time lag between the intention and then the external expression where hopefully we can catch it. So we start with those. Then, from there, we take the bodhisattva precepts, which are more difficult to keep because some of those you can transgress without saying or doing anything, just by what the mind is thinking. And similarly with the tantra precepts. Okay, so we always start with the things that are easier and then go to the things that are harder. But many people in America, they think the five precepts are old-fashioned and kind of stupid, and they would much rather have the bodhisattva and tantric precepts, thinking that they can keep those very well. But if those same people are asked to really keep the five precepts, they have quite a difficult time doing it. Okay? It's kind of like don't tell me not to lie. You know, that's just kind of some foolishness what they taught you in Sunday school. I'm going to keep the tantric precepts. But then you ask them, okay, try going a year without lying. And it's like, egads, you know. Not exaggerating anything in my speech, not kind of telling the story a little bit different. Not the little white lies, how about the big horrendous lies? You know, people find it quite difficult sometimes. It's not so easy to be truthful, is it? Okay? So, this is why we start with the body, with the physical, and go more subtle. So it's the same here with establishing mindfulness. Start with the body, then the feelings, then the mind. Okay, so we have to understand what the mind is. So there are primary consciousnesses, and then there are mental factors. A primary consciousness is what apprehends that object field, that type of object. So the visual primary consciousness apprehends colors and shapes. The auditory primary consciousness apprehends sounds. The olfactory primary consciousness apprehends smells. The gustatory consciousness apprehends taste. The tactile consciousness sounds. And then the mental consciousness can have some direct perceptions, but it's mostly, at least in our stage right now, conceptual mind. But it could also be a mind that's dreaming or a mind that's sleeping. But, you know, very much when we're awake, our conceptual thinking mind. Okay? So you can see that each of these six has its own field or its own kind of object. The ear doesn't see colors. Okay? And the tongue doesn't taste, you know, sounds. So they each have their own field. But to have a whole cognition, it isn't sufficient to have just the primary consciousness. There's these mental factors that come along with it that arise at the same time, share the same object, and have these different things that are in common with the primary consciousness that fill out the cognition, that, you know, make certain things about the cognition actually happen. Okay, so sometimes the analogy is made that the primary consciousness is like the palm of your hand and the mental factors are the fingers. You need the whole thing in order to pick something up. If you just have the palm, you can't pick something up. If you just have fingers, you can't either. So they all come together. Okay, so when we start to dissect the mind in this way, yeah, there's six primary consciousnesses, there's over 84,000 mental factors. When we start to study these and dissect the mind, then we begin to see that the mind isn't something solid. Yeah, because like I was saying before, we often think of our mind as being ourself. But when we dissect the mind and see that it has so many different parts, so many different aspects, well, how could that be the one thing that is this self-sufficient, substantially existent me, or this truly existent me? Yeah, it can't be, because the mind itself depends on parts. So anything, you know, that is depending on the mind or associated with the mind is also going to depend on parts. And so it can't be, you know, an independent entity that it doesn't rely on anything else. So it's very helpful for us to learn these different types of consciousnesses, so we can begin to dissect the mind and stop seeing it as one solid thing, like my personality, or my soul, you know, or myself, or however we feel that our mind is sometimes. Okay? So, like I said, there's the division into primary consciousness and mental factors. Primary consciousness, there's six of them. Yeah, You got it? Then, with the mental factors, there's over 84,000. But the Abhidharma scholars very kindly picked out the most important ones that are associated with either keeping us in cyclic existence or pulling us out of cyclic existence and attaining liberation, and highlighted those. And so we get this thing, at least in the, you know, as it's taught in the mind and awareness textbooks now, of 51 mental factors. So these mind and awareness textbooks rely a lot on the Abhidharma Kosh by Vasubandhu, and also the Compendium of Knowledge, the Abhidharma Samuchaya by his brother Asanga. Yeah, so they rely on a lot on those two texts. So I thought to go briefly over the 51 mental factors. Well, we've done whole courses on them before, and I think there's some on the web and there's some in the library, and you can study those and look at those. But I thought to go briefly through them right now, because it just, when we think about them, it gives us a way of seeing how the mind has parts, and so thus seeing how the mind is not one monolithic entity that could be a self. Okay? So, there's, first of all, six basic divisions of the mental factors, each of which have different mental factors in them. So, the first division is called the five omnipresent mental factors. They're called omnipresent because they happen with every mind, with every primary mind. Then there's the second category is the five ascertaining mental factors. Yeah, they ascertain different aspects of the object. The third category is the 11 virtuous mental factors. So these are prominent in creating virtue. We want to practice and encourage these. Then we have the six root afflictions. So these are the chief ones that keep us in cyclic existence. They give rise to the 20 auxiliary afflictions, which are based on the six root. And then there's the four changeable mental factors, or four variable mental factors. Okay, so just to go briefly through these different categories, again, when we hit any one of these mental factors, remember that mental factor itself is not an entire cognition. It occurs together with a primary mind and with other mental factors. And so when we start with the five omniscient mental factors, you know, omnipresent, oops, the five omnipresent mental factors, they're there in every mental state, in every cognition. So, you know, they always come as a team. Okay? All of these, when we talk about, when we divide phenomena, to material things, mind, and then abstract composites, all of these primary consciousnesses and mental consciousnesses, they all go under the category of mind because they all share the quality of being clear and aware. Clear in the sense of not having form, of being able to reflect an object, aware in the sense of being able to relate to that object or engage with that object. Okay? So that's the definition. Somebody says, what is mind? Clarity and awareness. Or it's sometimes translated as luminosity and knowing. There's, you know, each of those words have different English synonyms. Okay? So these mental factors, like I said, they never occur again. They always occur with the primary consciousness and other mental factors. So the five omnipresent ones, so they're going to occur with our sense consciousnesses as well as our mental consciousness. So feeling is one of them. Okay. So feeling, we've already talked about it. Experience is pleasure, pain, and neutral. Discrimination or discernment is another one, and this is the mental factor that's able to tell the difference between different things. Okay, intention is the third of these five, and intention is the mind that moves the consciousness to the object. So this is sometimes the definition of karma, is this mental factor of intention. Okay? That's not saying that what creates karma is only this mental factor, because our actions can be virtuous or non-virtuous, and this mental factor alone is neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. But depending on other mental factors, whether you have some of the 11 virtuous ones or the 6 root, then that's going to influence the whole cognition to be either virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. Okay? And so thereby that mental factor of intention will be virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. Okay? So it's action, it's karma. It makes the mind engage, you know, go towards the object. Then the fourth of the omnipresent is contact. So that's what connects the object and the sense faculty with the mind so that there can actually be a cognition. And then the fifth one is attention, or sometimes mental engagement, but it also directs the mind towards a certain object, okay? Not with the intention of intention, but it, you know, it's attention, so it directs the mind towards the object. Okay, so those are there with all the cognitions. Okay. Then there's five object ascertaining mental factors, which generally speaking in our tradition we say that they are not present in all the cognitions. But in, I think, the Abhidharma, the Pali Abhidharma, they say that they are present in all the cognitions. Also, the Pali Abhidharma has a different, a slightly different list of the five omnipresent, because they have 7 of them, not 5. Okay, so the five object ascertaining ones. So they're so called because they apprehend the individual features of the object. Okay, so they're helping to fill out and make it a cognition. So aspiration is the first one. So it's what takes a strong interest in the object. Appreciation or belief stabilizes the apprehension of something we've previously ascertained, so that we believe in it, we appreciate it, we can't be distracted by something else. So you can see these are very important. What we aspire for is going to, you know, really make a big difference in our life. What we believe, also going to make a big difference. Okay, so how these mental factors, what objects they go to, is quite important. The third one is mindfulness. So this is what repeatedly brings our mind back to an object that we already know. And this is also the mental factor of memory. Okay. Then concentration, or samadhi, is one of these. So you see, you know, we have the mental factor of samadhi in us already. We just don't have full samadhi. But there's that mental factor that's there, and it's not going to go away. So we have the potential to develop it. Okay, and then the fifth one is called wisdom or intelligence. So this is the word cherub in Tibetan, or prajna in Sanskrit, panna in Pali, and it functions to discriminate precisely with analysis. What are the faults, the benefits, the characteristics of a particular object? So it's often translated as wisdom, as in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. But there's another word called yeshi that's often translated as wisdom too, sometimes as exalted wisdom. And the problem, you know, with this, with calling prajna wisdom, is that it's a word that's used in different ways in different contexts. And not all of them mean what the English word wisdom means. Okay? So, for example, the personality view, that one that grasps onto an inherently existent personality, that one is a type of cherub, a type of wisdom. But it's an inverted one. Okay? Because it, you know, is based on some discrimination and analysis of its objects. That's why it's called a type of wisdom. But it's analyzed and discriminated its object in completely the wrong way. Yeah? So it's an inverted wisdom or a non-virtuous wisdom. So that's why it's difficult translating the word prajna as wisdom. Okay? Sometimes people call it intelligence. You know, then you could say, yeah, some people have a wrong intelligence. You know, that makes sense in English. You know, you use your intelligence in the wrong way. That makes sense. Except we tend to think of intelligence as something that you're born with, whereas, you know, from a Buddhist viewpoint, there is some intelligence that comes from previous lives, but a lot of it is developed in this lifetime. Because when we talk about the wisdom of hearing, the wisdom of reflecting, the wisdom of meditating, it's that same word, prajna. Okay? So, but in that context, when you're talking about, you know, those three things, hearing, thinking, and meditating, it's more an understanding than a wisdom. The understanding arising from learning, the understanding arising from reflecting, the understanding arising from meditating. So you see, always translating that one word, prajna or sharap, as wisdom is a little bit dicey because it means different things in different contexts. Okay? So just to be aware of that, you know, you'll probably encounter that as you continue to study a little bit more. Okay. So those are the we have the five omnipresent, the five object ascertaining. I'm going very quickly through them. This is not meant to be an exhausted explanation so that you understand every detail of it. It's meant to be something that gives you an idea of the different parts and aspects of the mind so that you can see the mind is not one solid thing. Okay? And it's also designed to show us that we have different mental factors that are completely opposite one from the other, and they still exist within our mind stream. Things that are completely opposite. And we'll start getting into these as we, because we're talking about the 11 virtuous and then the 6 root afflictions and so on. And you'll see some of these are total opposite, and yet they all abide within our mind stream. So that also, when we understand that, gives us more of a feeling that we don't have a solid, concrete personality. You know, that there are these various mental factors, and you know, who we are, you know, in a conventional way, how we act, what our personality is, what our character is simply dependent upon which mental factors in these groups we cultivate and which ones we try and abandon and apply antidotes to. So it also helps us to see we don't have some fixed character or personality. Okay, so the 11 virtuous ones. The first one is called, is often translated as faith or confidence or trust. Okay? The problem with translating it as with faith is we get blind faith, and this is not blind faith. Okay? Problem with translating it as confidence is we usually think self-confidence, and that's not the complete meaning of this word. And trust, you know, trust can work too, but then we usually think of trust as some kind of intimate thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So just be aware whenever you hear confidence or trust or faith, that it's referring to this one. And so it refers to having confidence in things like the law of karma and its effects, the qualities of the three jewels. So it has faith in different things. And there's different kinds of faith, okay, or different kinds of trust. So one is called clear or admiring trust or faith, and so this sees the good qualities of, let's say, the triple gem, and then rejoices in them and admires them. Then there's aspiring faith that also sees the good qualities of the object and aspires to become like that. And then there's believing faith or convictional faith. And this is what arises after we've really done some investigation and understand something. And then we really have faith in it. Okay? So we might have, you know, if we do some study about impermanence and about emptiness, and we begin to have some understanding of them, then that also inspires faith in our minds, because we understand them. Okay? So then faith is actually a very, very important part of the path. If we don't have faith, if we don't have trust in the triple gem, in the three jewels, how are we ever going to practice the path? You know? If we don't trust the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we're not going to even bother learning the teachings, let alone putting them into practice. Okay? So faith or trust, confidence, this is very important for really getting anywhere on the path. Without it, we just stay as, you know, we're very skeptical. Our mind is like a piece of, you know, leather or concrete. Nothing goes in it because there's no softness to it, you know, of really, because, you know, when we have faith that's based on understanding, the mind is very receptive, the mind is very joyful. The mind, you know, can you think of times when you've had a lot of faith and how happy your mind is? Yeah? So, I mean, I just remember, like, those of you who have taken ordination here, the days when you've been ordained, your face looks completely different because there's very strong faith in the mind at that time, isn't there? You know, you're making a big step with complete confidence in what you're doing. And so the mind's very joyful and, you know, very sure of the direction it's going in. So you can see, you know, it's an important mental factor. Then there's integrity. So this is the one that avoids negativity for reason of our own personal consciousness, our own personal values. Sometimes this is translated as shame, but I don't think that's a good translation. If it is translated as shame, it's referring to the good kind of shame, as in, you know, where you really have a sense of self-respect and integrity and you don't want to do something that's wrong because, you know, how you feel about yourself. Okay, then the third one is consideration for others. And so this is, again, refraining from negativities because we're aware of the effect of our actions will have on others and we don't want our actions to damage others' faith and confidence and spirituality and so on. So we refrain from committing certain negative actions. The fourth one is non-attachment. So this isn't just the absence of attachment. It's actually the remedy to attachment. It's the balanced mind that doesn't exaggerate the good qualities of an object, that can look at the object and not get attached to it because it sees exactly what it is. Okay. And then the fifth one is non-anger, which again isn't just the absence of anger, but it's actually the opposite of it. It's actually the mind of love, okay? So it's the mind that, you know, isn't just not angry, but is the antidote to anger, just as non-attachment was the antidote to attachment. Then the sixth one is non-confusion. So, again, not just the mere absence of confusion, but the antidote to it. Yeah, so it's going to be involved with, you know, hearing, thinking, meditating, gaining some kind of understanding. So those three, you know, we see we have faith first, then we have two that help us refrain from negative actions, the integrity and the concealment and the consideration for others. Then we have three of them that are opposite of the three poisonous minds. Okay, non-attachment, non-anger, non-confusion. Seventh one is joyous effort. So this is the mind that counteracts laziness and takes delight in virtue. Then eighth is responsiveness. This one is often translated as pliancy, as flexibility. I'm playing with the translation of responsiveness because it's a mental factor that can apply itself to a virtuous object, thus making the mind and the body very responsive to what you want to do. Okay, it makes the mind and body flexible and pliant and serviceable, not stiff and resistant. Okay, the reason I don't like pliancy and flexibility is it makes me think of gymnastics, you know? Yeah. Okay, so that eighth one is responsiveness. Ninth one is conscientiousness. So this is a mind that cherishes virtue, okay? It really thinks doing the right thing and creating virtue is a really important thing. So we can see that this is an important mental factor. Okay. Then the tenth one is non-harmfulness, which is actually the mental factor of compassion. Yeah, so it lacks any intention to harm and actually wants sentient beings to be freed from suffering. And then the 11th virtuous one is called equanimity. And so there's different kinds of equanimity, many different kinds of equanimity in Buddhism. But this is the kind that when we are developing concentration and serenity, enables the mind to remain equal and not get involved with laxity, not get involved in with agitation, not apply the antidote when we don't need to, not forgetting to apply the antidote when we need to. So it's that kind of equanimity that enables the mind to actually stay focused on a virtuous object. So these are the 11 virtuous ones that are delineated here. There's actually many more because, you know, we'll start out with the 6 root afflictions, which can be divided into 10, and then the 20, auxiliary afflictions, and you go, oh, but they're mostly non-virtuous, and how come there's so many more non-virtuous ones than virtuous? Well, you know, they're kind of equal, but I think they really outline the non-virtuous ones and the ones that interfere with liberation very extensively so that we become aware of them and stop following them. Okay? So there are the 6 root afflictions, but these can be the last one, afflicted views, can be subdivided into 5, and then that gives us 10. Okay, so they're called afflictions, first because they're the root of cyclic existence, and second because they are the root of the auxiliary ones. Okay, so first one, attachment. So attachment's the one that is based on exaggerating the attractiveness of the object and holding it. Second one is anger, based on exaggerating the unattractive aspects of an object and wanting to push away or destroy. Third one, conceit or pride. And so this is based upon the view of a personal identity that apprehends an inherently existent I or mind, and it grasps at a very inflated view of ourselves. Okay? So just, you know, we are so important. And there's various different branches of this one. Then the fourth one is ignorance. So this is a state of unknowing, partly a state of unknowing where the mind is just muddy and can't see the object clearly. But from the viewpoint of the upper schools, it's not just a cloudiness, an unclarity of the mind, but it includes at the grasping at true existence. So it's also a mind that apprehends things as existing in the exact opposite way from how they actually exist. Okay? And of course, included in ignorance, there's two main kinds of ignorance. This ignorance that is regarding how things are, that's, you know, grasping at true existence from the viewpoint of the Prasangikas. And then the ignorance that doesn't understand how karma and its effects operate. And so with that kind of ignorance, we have no sense of or respect for ethical discipline. We just do whatever because it's all the same. Okay, the fourth one is deluded doubt. So this isn't the doubt that is inclined towards the correct answer or towards the medium one, but this is a deluded doubt that is really inclined towards the wrong conclusion over important things. It's not, you know, are you doubting whether, I don't know, to cook things on a 350 or 400 oven, you know. It's not that kind of doubt. It's doubt about, you know, does karma and its effects really exist? Do the three jewels really exist? Is enlightenment possible? Okay? So doubt is very problematic because doubt's like a two-pointed mind. You can't go anywhere. And this doubt is explicitly inclined towards the wrong conclusion. So you not only can't go anywhere, but you're leaning in the bad direction. Okay? So very difficult state of mind. And then the sixth one is called afflicted views. And those, again, can be subdivided into five kind of afflicted views. So these are kind of important. So the first one is the view of the personal identity. So this is the one that grasps onto there being an inherently existent I or mine. The second afflicted view is view of the extremes. So it's based on the view of the personal identity of this solid inherently existent I. And it thinks that either the I is totally annihilated at death, so that there's no rebirth, or the I is some kind of eternal solid thing, so it's a soul or self that goes on to the next life completely unchanged. So that's why it's called view of the extremes. It grasps onto those two extremes of absolutism and nihilism. The third one, the third afflictive view is distorted view. So this is the one it's actually wrong view. It's better to call it wrong view. So this one is a kind of afflictive wisdom that denies the existence of something that exists or says that something that doesn't exist exists. So again, over important things involving the path to freedom. You know, it's not, you know, does Iran have, what's the state of Iran's, you know, nuclear arsenal? It's not kind of wrong views about that. It's you know, saying like karma doesn't exist or enlightenment is possible or sentient beings are inherently selfish. There's nothing you can do. Okay. Then the fourth afflictive view is the view holding distorted views as supreme. So this is the mind that looks at all the other wrong views and says, these are the best views to have. Everybody should have them. Okay? And then the fifth one, We talked about a few sessions ago, which is the view holding bad ethics and modes of conduct as supreme. So the one that thinks that, you know, certain actions that are in fact non-virtuous are virtuous, and that doing all kinds of strange practices will lead you to liberation when in fact they don't. Okay, so those are the five afflictive views. So altogether we get the 10, which can be abbreviated into the 6 root afflictions. Okay, so let's stop here for right now, see if you have any questions. Yeah?
In the list of the virtuous ones, what's the value of looking at the list of the nuns, looking at them as non-attachment or looking at them as non-hatred, as opposed to just saying love?
Oh, okay. So with the three nons, non-attachment, non-anger, non-confusion, what's the advantage of saying non instead of saying the positive thing? I think this is just my guess. I don't have a chance to ask Vasubandhu or Asanga. But my guess is to really point out that they are the opposites and they are the antidotes to the three poisonous minds. To really point that out, you know, that they're not just the lack of those, but they're minds that apprehend and relate to things in exactly the opposite way.
Okay. My second question is, I'm reading a book on this topic now, and he translates discrimination as conception. Does that make any sense?
Okay, so the one of discrimination, that it's one of the five omnipresent ones, people translate that all different ways. In the Pali translators often translate it as perception. I have no idea why, because it's not perception. Some people translate it as conception, but it's not conception either, because it occurs with non-conceptual minds. You know, it can be, some people call it discrimination. Some people call it discernment, like you can discern different features or characteristics of an object. Okay? So it you know, there's not one uniform translation for it. Okay? That's why with all of these, it's really important to understand the meaning and not just project our usual meaning onto them. Okay? But, you know, it's definitely not conception, because conception, you know, a conceptual mind is one that apprehends its objects by means of a conceptual appearance. But, you know, when you have a direct perception of, you know, the eye consciousness seeing green, and it can discern and discriminate green as something different than red and different than yellow, that's, you know, just on the basis of raw sense data, it can discern that. So it's not conceptual.
Yeah, it was confusing.
Yeah. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
I'm not sure if I heard you right. When you were describing mind and abstract composites, and then you were saying that I think both primary minds and mental factors go into the category of mind.
Yeah. Okay. When we take the big category of impermanent phenomena or conditioned phenomena, it can be subdivided into material, mind, and abstract composites. Okay, so all the minds, the primary consciousnesses and mental factors go in that one that's called mind, because they all share that the attribute of clarity and awareness. Okay? Yeah?
I was wondering about just one of the things you said at the start of the teaching before really getting into it, but that there's nothing really inherent here to grasp onto because you know, we're always changing. Why is it the path laid out in a way that we initially are contemplating with regards to our own future rebirths being more important than others? Because it seems like sometimes my future births are just as disparate from myself now as any other sentient being is.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So why is it laid up? Like, why not just jump into compassion from the get-go?
Okay. So why is the path laid out with our own future rebirth being the easiest motivation to, you know, and the first one to generate on the path, and then the motivation for our own liberation, which is another step higher, and then bodhicitta, which is wanting full enlightenment for the benefit of others, you know, as the last one? Why don't we just go right to bodhicitta at the beginning? Because bodhicitta is imbued with compassion. And doesn't this one of looking out for our own rebirth, isn't it kind of self-centered and limited? And why are we encouraged to kind of want that in the first place?
Not even that it's self-centered, but that it's not self-centered because we're not going to be the same self.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't feel like it's going to be.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. I see what you're saying. So why are we thinking about our own future rebirth when, to our mind right now, our next life feels just as un-me as, you know, as the cat? You know, why not cherish Manju's future rebirth as much as I cherish my future rebirth? Because they're both so completely not me. Okay? Equally not me. Okay, that way of looking at things is really demonstrative of how much we grasp at inherent existence and how much we think of, when we say I, as I being the present body and the present mind. And we're so focused on that when we say I, this present body, this present mind, so much so that the future life, you know, the continuum of the mind and the different body seems as totally unrelated to us as Manjushri's aggregates, or as the deer's aggregates, okay, or the neighbor's aggregates. They're so completely unrelated to us. So this is because of the grasping, the way we grasp at inherent existence. When our grasping at inherent existence starts to subside, and also our grasping at permanence starts to diminish a little bit, then we begin to see that the mind has a continuity and that the future moments are not the same as this moment, but this moment exists in a relationship to that future continuity as the cause of it. So what we do this moment is going to have an effect on that future continuity that it's not going to have on the aggregates of somebody else. Okay, if I create virtue or non-virtue, it's going to affect, you know, the body and mind I have in my future life. It's not going to affect the body and mind the cat has in his future life, or that you have in your future life. Okay, but you see, we're so focused on, you know, what is me, this body, this mind, whoever I feel to be right now. And that's what keeps us from getting any kind of sense of existing in a continuum. You know, even so much so that if you really sit down, you know, try and think about it and imagine being a baby. Can you imagine that your mind was once a baby's mind? You know? Just think of how babies look. You know, they don't understand so much, the no verbal capacity to express themselves. Yeah, not understanding what's going around, being frightened even of their own crying. Do you have any feeling inside of you that you used to be like that? And that your body, you know, at one time was this big? Do you have a feeling this thing was one time this big? Or even smaller, that big? No, we don't have any sense of it, do we? And yet we know full good and well that, you know, our body was once this big inside of our mom's womb. And that our mind was as, you know, as ignorant and confused as a baby's mind, that we had a baby's mind. you know, and didn't understand any of these things. But it's so hard to imagine from where we are now to think that we were once like that. Or when we think of aging, you know, we hear about dementia and Alzheimer's. It's other people who get dementia and Alzheimer's. You know, me, I'm always going to be me in my old age. I have this personality, you know, and I'm always going to have these same cognitive abilities. But, you know, and when you're with somebody who has dementia or Alzheimer's, you relate to them as if they came out of their mother's womb like that, don't you? But they were once kind of young with a bright, alert mind. We just didn't know them at that time. You know, but bright and alert and an attractive young body and very healthy. And now, look at what happened to that continuum. Very hard for us to really accept that. And yet we know it's true. What makes it difficult to accept? Because we're so focused on grasping at this inherently existent I as our present body and mind. Yeah, and so for that reason, you know, even thinking about our next rebirth seems as alien as thinking about the rebirth of, you know, the bug in Timbuktu. It has nothing to do with me. But actually, it has a lot to do with us. Because what we do now, the same, you know, just as we have this sense of I right now, and this grasping at I right now, we're going to have that same sense in a future life. Yeah, that same sense. It'll be in relationship to different aggregates. But that same sense of, I want to be happy and I don't want to suffer. And we're creating the causes right now for our own future happiness and suffering. Okay. So one way we say our own future happiness and suffering, because it's a continuity of who we are now. But in another way we say, oh, the person I am in my next life, happiness and suffering, because in another way, that person is different than who we are now because it's different aggregates. So remember a long time ago we talked about the general self and the specific self? That's what this is relating to. Okay? Okay? Okay, so we'll stop here. But in the next week, you know, really try to identify some of these different mental factors in your mind. Try to identify even the different primary consciousnesses that are operating, you know. And especially try and discern, you know, like when you're eating, when is the taste consciousness operating? When is the tactile consciousness? And when is the mental consciousness? Yeah, and try and, like, you know, when you're chewing your food, differentiate between those three. It's quite interesting. Yeah? So it gives us more of a sense of the mind not being something solid. Okay? And more of a sense of being able to change different aspects.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhotse's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Puryatara, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Akshavastiya be in the West Glory.